All right. Welcome, everyone, back to another edition of New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen, and today I'm excited to bring us a book that comes from not sort of the ivory tower of academia, but somebody outside of academia, but has a really great insight to, I think, what's going on in higher education, what's going on in all of education, really. So I have Ryan Craig, who's Managing Director of University Ventures, and this is his book, College Disrupted, The Great Unbundling of Higher Education. And this was just published this year from Palgrave Macmillan with St. Martin's Press. Ryan, thank you for joining me today.
Ryan, it's a delight to be here, and I hope that the insights are great. I was recently introduced at a conference as the most insightful investor in higher education, and to which I responded, that's like being called the tallest midget. So not a high bar, perhaps.
No, I think it's great to have, we don't just have professors that have insights in education, I think. So this is great for the page, for sure. If we could, maybe just give us a little bit of your background and how you got into education. I know that plays right a factor into the book and kind of ties in as well. So if you want to let our audience know.
Yeah, happy to. So I'm from Canada originally. Got into Yale when I was applying to university. And I was fortunate enough that my grandparents were able to help me pay for that. And it really opened up just an entirely different world to me. In Canada, you know, you fill out one form and rank your universities, and you just, you know, you find out you know, where you're going. Here, it's a real thing. it's a process, and that opened up my my eyes. And so, my senior year at Yale for my economics major, I did my thesis comparing the undergraduate systems of Canada and the U.S. and doing sort of an econometric analysis, trying to correlate whether there was a difference in the two systems as to how they produced in terms of their inputs on a per institution basis versus their outputs. And it was a really interesting paper, got some media coverage, actually won a prize, and that was sort of what you know, spawned the bug and love of education. A few years later, while I was in law school, I connected up with a gentleman who was doing some work for NBC, a gentleman by the name of Peter Price, and he was trying to develop some new businesses for NBC. This was in the sort of go-go dot-com era. And a plan was hatched for NBC to partner with Columbia and Cambridge universities to create something called the World University. This was 1998, I believe. So sort of pre the era of the online university. Didn't happen, but Columbia got the bug. And so after I graduated from law school in 1999, went to work for Mike Crowe, now the president of ASU, who was then executive vice provost at Columbia, helping Columbia develop an online initiative that became Fathom. And so I spent 2 years really thinking about what universities could be doing online, should be doing online, what they shouldn't be doing online, and went from there to Warburg Pincus, the large private equity firm where I essentially created their education and training group. And in the process, co-founded a company that became Bridgepoint Education, which at its peak was 90,000 students almost entirely online, one of the fastest growing universities in U.S. history. And I've been on the board of Bridgepoint since its inception. So I've been involved since then with many different education companies and ventures, and currently now run a fund called University Ventures, which is the only private equity fund solely focused on investing in higher education. So we invest in companies that partner with traditional universities to help them do things they otherwise couldn't do or don't want to do or aren't good at. So our companies bring capital, technology, management, and innovation, and partner with universities to help them develop and deliver higher return on investment programs for students. So that's, in a nutshell, my story.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I think a lot of that experience you can see right in the book, all the way up from sort of your decision to go to Yale, sort of your working experience. You have a great story in there about being, I believe, a waiter and having these dreams at night, which I was a waiter in college as well. And I've said, yes, absolutely. I'm shaking my head. Yes. But can we kind of talk about, I mean, this is really sort of a criticism of the current sort of higher education system that we have here. What exactly is this disruption and sort of, I think you present these four R's, which is really great, rankings, research, real estate, and raw. So I think that's a nice way to kind of set us up. Can you describe what those are and why they're important to universities? Maybe why those things shouldn't be important potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an interesting time because as we speak, we're just a few days past the Department of Education's release of the first income data that's been correlated to financial aid data, which really is going to be, it does provide outcome data for the first time. We know, at least with regard to students who took out federal loans, how much your graduates or your former students are actually making in the workforce 10 years out of school. Really interesting, and a far cry from the criteria that U.S. News and the other so-called rankings use. They're almost entirely inputs, right? So they're ranking reputation, they're ranking selectivity, they're ranking faculty resources, they're ranking endowment per student, they're ranking alumni contributions. All of which are inputs, have nothing to do with the actual outputs of the institution. They're essentially two or three outputs that matter, right? One is, are students learning? And that's probably the hardest to measure. The second is, well, what are graduates, what are your former students actually making in the workforce? And the third, and perhaps harder, is, are they happy? Are your graduates happy? Are they happy with the experience? But none of the rankings systems as they exist currently measure that. So in effect, the metric by which institutions and more importantly the boards of trustees, the governors of these institutions that are trying to determine whether they're actually meeting their stated missions. So the criteria that we're using, the yardstick, if you will, is flawed. Right, rankings is one. Another one, which is another easy to measure yardstick, is research. Right, where are we in terms of research dollars, research grants, and so forth? And if we're up from last year, then we're successful. If not, but again, really has nothing to do with any of the outputs, the outcomes that I just mentioned. A third one is real estate, right? Are we putting up great new buildings? What does our architecture look like? There's a piece in the Chronicle this week about I think it's Syracuse University that's trying to innovate, if you will, through interesting architecture. That's nice, but really has nothing to do with student outcomes. And the fourth one is college sports, athletics. Am I seeing my team performing on Saturdays? So all those things, again, easy to measure, easy for a trustee to say, like, yeah, our institution's in good shape, but really having nothing to do with the things that actually matter, namely student outcomes. So it leads to a kind of isomorphism, which is, if you will, sort of the major criticism I have in the book. I mean, I talk about the crisis of affordability, crisis of completion in the book. But fundamentally, it really all comes back to the fact that institutions, which really different institutions, which should be serving, which do serve a great diversity of students. In fact, that's our number one strength as a system. It's that we serve greater diversity of students from a socioeconomic standpoint, from a racial diversity standpoint, than any other country's higher education system in the world. And yet, how is it possible that every institution should essentially use the same yardstick by which to measure itself? So the four R's. Not every institution uses every R, certainly, but most use most of them. And in reality, doing a great disservice by encouraging isomorphism, which means that higher education institutions are converging on a singular model. And in fact, we would be much better served by a much greater diversity of models and of products, if you will. So, the major product of higher education is the degree program. We've seen a huge increase in the growth of certificate programs, but not one that's really encouraged or motivated by the system or the rewards available to players in the system. So, we strongly believe that the market is pushing in the direction of a, much greater panoply of programs and products likely a shorter and easier to complete than a degree is, while still yielding credentials that are not only sort of equally understood by the end consumer of those credentials, namely the employer, but probably better understood. Because if you ask employers today, they really don't understand what they're getting when they get an employee with a degree. They're not understanding it at the level of the competency. They're understanding it that this is something that took 4 years and is difficult to complete, and therefore the employee, the prospective employee, has the stick-to-itiveness that they need to complete. But it doesn't really say anything more than that about the competencies of the employee's hard skills or soft skills. And so we foresee a future where the degree is unbundled, if you will, in the same way that other industries have seen their products unbundled. Music with the CD or the record album, if you're old enough to remember that. Cable bundles in, yeah. In television, you don't need to be getting all 500 channels. You can choose the the 50 or a few that you. That you actually want to buy. Same in higher education. A degree, if you will, is a large bundle that almost by historical accident has become the currency of the labor market. Both of the major players in the labor market, employees and employers, would prefer a much finer grained currency, one that actually speaks to the level of the competency, as opposed to one that's been determined by how it is that our universities have evolved historically over the past few centuries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I really like how sort of you talk about where this isomorphism, where we're going, everyone's trying to be either like this very elite sort of wannabe Harvard, or maybe even if I can, maybe they want to be Ohio State University with this big football team and really expensive tuition, things like that. But that's not really the reality for most students. Most students are, I think you point out, are part-time, are adults, or older than the sort of 18 to 22-year-old, which you describe, we created these quote-unquote playpens for an 18 to 22-year-old, and that's not really serving our resources or things that we're investing in.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's understandable, right? Because the majority of faculty across all institutions, including non-elite institutions, have actually attended, top 200 universities, right? So the top 200 universities educate something like 75% of all tenured faculty across all institutions, including community colleges, including, state university systems and so forth. So these are people who know what excellence is because they had it when they themselves were an undergraduate or graduate student. And in a sense, the tragedy of what's happened in our higher education system is all of these decision makers across the system trying to sort of recapture the excellence of their youth rather than designing their institutions in a way that maximizes student outcomes given the level of resources that they have.
Mm-hmm. And I think, what is sort of a model, or what should we be looking for? Or what could universities be doing? I think you provide an example of a university in Missouri, the technical university. Or can you kind of describe what that looks like, or some of those characteristics?
Yeah, I mean, that's an example of an institution that has created what we call a double-click degree, essentially, which, again, the degree is a fairly opaque credential so far as the employer is concerned, and the transcript is really not used at all in the hiring process. And if you talk to employers, the only ones who say they use it, they use it almost as a lie detector test, where they're basically saying, did you take this? What grade did you get? And so forth in it, but they're not actually looking at the skills or competencies that students purportedly gained through their learning, because it's just not available to them. So the point of that, I call that a way station on the road to unbundling, because it is something that really any institution can do once they begin speaking the language of competencies, is to take the transcript from an opaque, fairly useless instrument to one where employers and others who are interested can double click on courses or learning experiences and understand what competencies a student who achieved at this level in that learning experience should be able to exhibit. So that's a great example. I mean, I think in terms of, you know, looking at the road forward, I mean, we're not the only ones looking at what I call just-in-time providers. So these are the, you know, coding boot camps and other alternative players that, you know, folks in the Department of Education are very enthusiastic about and trying to bring into the Title IV universe through a demonstration program they're going to be announcing in the next few weeks. But, you know, just-in-time education really, I think, represents the future of higher education. If you think about what's happened in the software industry over the last, 10, 15 years, 10, 15 years ago, companies sold and bought enterprise software, right, which is a huge software package, a lot of which you never used, pay a big price tag for it. You buy it once, and then you pay annual maintenance for it. If you look at your own university, you'll see that your green screen SIS system that you use was probably bought once, 20, 30 years ago, and it's impossible to rip it out. So fast forward to today, we've replaced enterprise software with SaaS, right? Enterprise software has been destroyed. SaaS is software that you don't buy, you rent, essentially, and you pay for what you need when you need it. So that's sort of how that's evolved. So similarly, higher education today, the view is you pay a lot of money to get your degree once, right? You do it, typically you're supposed to do it between when you're 18 and 24. Then you have your annual maintenance payments, the equivalent would be your alumni dues or something, and you're done, right? You don't worry about it again. A SaaS model of higher education is you buy when you need what you need when you need it, right? So you might go to school for 3 months, learn some skills, work, and then come back and do another three-month experience, a credential that, again, has meaning in the workforce. That's a SaaS model. You pay for what you need when you need it. The reason we're not there yet is that we don't have the data and the systems yet to give students a roadmap as to what they need when they need it, right? But that's coming. And that's really the punchline of the book, which is I talk about competency marketplaces and this revolution we're seeing in data technology, where algorithms are able to parse job descriptions and extract the competencies that are required for those jobs with some level of confidence, and they're able to do the same for resumes and transcripts. And in so doing, you can match candidates or students or graduates with jobs. And that's what competency marketplaces are going to do. LinkedIn is an example of that. We think that in higher education, ePortfolio, companies like Portfolium are going to be successful in creating competency marketplaces, specifically purpose-built at the university level, mm-hmm. where you're literally matching jobs and students on the basis of competencies, which is not to say that students are going to be, placed into jobs on the basis of an algorithm. Far from it. But think about what's happening today in terms of how hiring works. You know, today every job posting is getting 150 to 250 resumes and applications. Companies, including small companies, but certainly all mid-size and large companies, use application tracking systems to screen those resumes. Humans don't look at all of those resumes. They run them through an ATS, and the ATS is filtering based on keyword. So they're literally looking at whether or not there are some of the same words in the resume as are in the job description, which leads to a funny phenomenon called resume spam, where students are copying the job description in white font behind their resume to get past the ATS screen. So that's the filtering that we have today. It's crude. It doesn't work. And when companies are trying to decide which 10 or 20 students they want to, or candidates they want to interview, they're getting probably half of them are false positives, and there's a ton of false negatives that they're excluding incorrectly. So what competency marketplaces will do is they will make that filtering or screening mechanism, a lot more accurate on the basis of competency. So if you're interviewing 20 people, 20 candidates, you're not going to have hopefully any false negatives, nor will you have false positives, at least on the basis of competencies. Now, then you interview those candidates and you determine which of them is the best fit for you in terms of culture and behavior and so forth. So it's going to improve fit and reduce the likelihood of bad hires. But fundamentally, for higher education, what it means is that students are going to finally have a GPS, right? They're going to have a GPS for their education and career, their human capital development. And they're going to know that if I want to become an environmental engineer, that the competencies required to be an environmental engineer are listed here, and there are many of them. And I don't just mean sort of hard skills. I mean everything from sort of core cognitive skills, executive function skills, things that make you a successful professional, communication skills, problem solving skills, and so forth. All of this can be it's data, and it's difficult, complex data, but it's the kind of things that people are working through in sort of big data and algorithms and so forth. We will have an opportunity. Students will have the opportunity to determine what the competencies required for that career are, and they'll be able to determine, okay, well, what's the best path for me to get from where I am today to where I need to be? And the answer is probably not going to be a four-year degree. For many of them, it's going to be a series of short courses, assessments, maybe a massive open online course, project work, and so forth. And then the competency marketplace will stamp me as qualified for the job, to the point that I at least make it past the ATS filter, and will be considered by a human being for the position.
If I could, you jump back to the point you just mentioned. You mentioned MOOCs. How much of a factor do those play into this idea of disruption, if you could?
None. In fact, it's the opposite. It's been a distraction, and institutions that have actually focused on MOOCs and deployed resources against them have found themselves slipping further behind from an innovation standpoint. I think we were the first public skeptic of MOOCs. We came out in February of 2012 and said that we've seen this movie before, we know how it ends, and there's no model here for scaling. We then went on to compare MOOCs to the Spice Girls, saying that, while they were viewed as revolutionary, and, think back 3 years ago, the New York Times wrote, I think at the end of 2012, that this is the biggest higher education story of the decade, and they declared 2012 to be the year of the MOOC. So a lot of flash and viewed as sort of revolutionary, but in fact, just more of the same of what came before, right? So the Spice Girls, for those of you old enough to remember, remember the Spice Girls, they were viewed the same way, revolutionary and so forth, but actually it was just a girl version of a boy band. In fact, that's how they were put together. But it was a bunch of managers in London in the mid-90s who put out an ad saying, we're going to create a girl version of NSYNC or the Backstreet Boys, and that's sort of what the Spice Girls were. And yet, they were still important. So in the late 90s in the UK, the Spice Girls did represent something important. It represented sort of this era of Cool Britannia and Tony Blair and, the end of two decades of Tory rule and so forth. And I was there at the time, and it was a pretty cool feeling. In the same way, MOOCs represent something important. They represent the moment that online learning became relevant and important for all of higher education, not just sort of a niche that we would associate with distance education or correspondence education or continuing education or for-profit education, but something that every university, no matter how elite, needed to have a strategy around. And if you didn't have one, you could potentially be fired, like the chancellor of UVA almost was. I think that's the importance of MOOCs. All of the MOOC companies have moved on to different models at this point. They'll tell you that they're not MOOC companies. They're more sort of just-in-time providers trying to create alternative credentials that have meaning. That's always been our view, is that what has value in the market is not content or courses, but credentials that have value and are understood by employers in the marketplace. So that's what companies like Coursera and Udacity are trying to create. I think it's hard to try to create a credential from scratch. It's very difficult. I think that at the end of the day, you need to have employer engagement in the educational program in order to achieve placement if you're trying to offer some kind of alternative credential. And that's not something that Udacity or Coursera currently does. And so, I don't think it's really part of the sort of innovation or disruption narrative that's happening in higher education. As I said before, I think that there's much more disruption coming on the data side, right? I mean, so we just saw what the Department of Education's data release and tying federal financial aid data to IRS data, and the potential that it's going to have a huge change in terms of how we think about universities, in terms of the ranking systems. I don't see how you can be a responsible ranking system and not incorporate that data, that income data that the government has now made available. Flawed though it may be, it's still much better than what we had before. And so it's gonna turn what was essentially a sort of reputation based economy in higher education, where people made decisions on what college to attend and what programs to study on the basis, not of real data, but on the basis of reputations, to one, decisions that are based on real data. And then I think in a few years, as I said before, we're going to see that same transition on the sort of, post-college side, when you're actually looking for work. Today, our students are choosing employers primarily on the basis of reputation, not on the basis of any data. And employers are selecting students in the same way. And we're going to have real data. The data's there. It just needs to be sort of parsed and matched. And it's going to have a huge change on how colleges and universities operate and on the programs and products that they offer.
Okay. Well, I think that all certainly makes sense. If we could, maybe I can ask you about private or for-profit actors in this space. I think you kind of give a good example of Forbes sort of giving licensing its name out to a for-profit university and then sort of creating this Forbes University as sort of an example of something that could be done. So what's your sense on the for-profit or private side?
Yeah, no, so I think there are two things bound up in what you just said. I think, for-profit higher education has a bad name at this point, because I think a lot of the for-profit universities took advantage of what was a very fast-growing market and offered programs that cost too much relative to the quality they were providing. I think that in almost every case, the quality of what they were providing was still superior to what, say, for example, most community colleges were offering. The problem was not a quality issue; it was a pricing issue because they were charging 3, 4, 5x what the community colleges charged to do it, and spending much of that on marketing and enrollment. So that's sort of where they ran into trouble. Having said that, I talk in the book, I have a chapter called A Tale of Two Cities, where I talk about sort of the challenges that these for-profit universities face relative to the incredible innovation we're seeing amongst private companies in higher education. And most of these companies are what I call service providers, companies that partner with universities to help them do things they need to do but aren't perfectly good at doing or don't want to do. So, for example, helping the university go online, recruiting international students, trying to relocate students who've dropped out and bring them back to the university, help them complete degree programs, disaggregating your existing IT degree offerings into more consumable bootcamp-like programs and credentials. These are things that universities aren't going to do themselves and certainly aren't going to do themselves at scale, but they can partner with market-driven, student-centric companies to do. I think that in time, the dynamism of these fast-growing companies will soon outshine the sort of lost luster of these large for-profit universities, which are just getting smaller year after year. At this point, the value propositions of most of these universities are not particularly attractive, by and large. As I said, primarily because it's a pricing issue. The second part of what you were
what you were asking was sort of the power of brands. And, you know, I think that in higher education, going forward, where we're going to see growth is really on both ends of the market, what I would call discount value propositions and then premium value propositions. And it's the same thing we're seeing in other sectors too, in the restaurant sector, in the retail sector. We're seeing, for example, Chipotle or Shake Shack thriving because they know what they do. They do it relatively inexpensively. It's a quality product for that level of expense, consumers are flocking to them. Likewise, premium dining, fine dining, never been in better shape. It's the middle. It's the restaurants in the middle, right? The TGI Fridays, the Chili's, and so forth, where they're shrinking. The Olive Gardens, the Red Lobsters. No one wants to eat there, right? If you will, they're poor facsimiles of a fine dining experience. They're not offering the quality of, you know, for a sit down meal. Although, you know, the breadsticks might be good. So, same in retail, right? Dollar stores thriving, Nordstrom's thriving, but you know, JCPenney and Sears and so forth really suffering. So we're seeing a hollowing out of the market. I think we're going to see the same thing in higher education, where universities will need to decide what they want to be. Are they a discounter? Or are they a premium provider? And if you're a premium provider, you really need to make sure that you're sort of checking all the boxes in terms of premium. Do you have a premium brand, right? Are you providing premium content and services? And are you helping the student get the job, right? So it's hard to say you're a premium provider if your students aren't getting the jobs they want at the end of the road. I think those are the three elements of a premium provider. I haven't met a university that hasn't said they're a premium provider, but I also haven't met one that has been able to tell me credibly they have all three, they can check all three of those boxes at this point. So I think the market will see through many of those institutions, and they really, you know, will be sort of in that middle of the market, which will be shrinking. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you can be a discount institution, which is to say you're offering the degree for as inexpensively as you can, kind of an everyday low pricing type model. And in order to do that, it's going to have to be a online or at least blended and likely a competency-based delivery to do that. And there's going to be huge demand for that, I've no doubt about it. But not a lot of traditional universities are particularly excited about going down that road, again, because of the isomorphism that so infects higher education. Everyone knows excellence, and they, you know, want to aspire to that excellence. So everyone is going to aim to be a premium institution, but many of them won't succeed.
Right. So that, I mean, that's sort of gets into this idea of a two-tiered system, essentially, what you're talking about. I think you describe sort of these elite institutions as almost like a debutante analogy that you use. Can you kind of talk about that? And, you know, we're going to eventually say, oh, that's kind of quaint what you're doing there, but the rest of us have moved on, essentially.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, so today when you hear that a friend's son or daughter has come out as a debutante, I think we all react like, oh, that is quaint. You know, that's, you know, it's kind of old fashioned. Did you really have to do that? That sounds expensive, and so forth. Maybe you did that as a, you know, sort of signal of your social status, and so forth. Once we've gone through unbundling, and once students sort of have the GPS. They need to make the right decisions and buy what they want when they need it in terms of their post-secondary education. I think that for many, it will increasingly look sort of quaint and unnecessary to sort of, you know, have that experience. Having said that, I have no doubt that, you know, lead and top, you know, 50 institutions will continue to have lines out the door for a long, long time just because of the rich, immersive, networking benefits of an elite education. But again, I don't want to spend too much time talking about the Ivy League because it's such a small part of the system. From a percentage standpoint, we're talking about, you know, sort of less than 5% of the market. We're much more focused on the 95%. And I think that for the 95% who aren't attending elite institutions, it really will seem like a debutante. To go and earn a degree from a non-elite institution, why would you do that? So, I think we are heading towards a two-tier system, a very small, you know, country clubbish, elite, immersive experience, the college ideal, if you will, for the wealthiest and certainly the top students, and those who aren't able to achieve at that level, they will have a much more efficient system, one that doesn't emulate to be something that it's not, which is what we have today, and that I think is one major reason why almost 46% of students who start degree programs don't complete them. The point is to have less expensive programs with much higher completion rates and that yield credentials that have greater meaning to employers and therefore will accrue greater value to students. So that's sort of where I think we're heading. And I think that sort of latter category is likely to be a combination of online and blended delivery. To those of us who had the benefit of an elite university experience, it sounds, sad and unequal and so forth. But the fact of the matter is the system we have now is sad and unequal because students are not completing their degree programs. They're leaving with tens of thousands of dollars in debt, often without any credential of value. And there's nothing sadder than that. I think we should aim to have a system that serves students where they are and is designed to deliver credentials of value that they can complete and derive value from, as opposed to trying to complete the credentials the wealthy designed 150 years ago. The system is not serving this, broad, diverse population particularly well.
Okay, yeah, fantastic. Well, I think we're kind of coming up on the end of the interview, but maybe one or two more questions. If you could, maybe we can put these together. What are some of the, I think, biggest sort of hurdles that either you sort of people have talked about when they have read your book and then maybe saw you later, or that you even sort of foresaw when you were writing the book? And then just any final word, last word for the audience that will hopefully go and check this out.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, when I talk with sort of policymakers and so forth, a lot of people in traditional higher ed just don't believe this. They don't believe that technology is going to have the kind of changes that, I'm talking about on higher education, because it's always been thus, right? Our system of higher education has not really changed that much in the past 100 years, ever since we adopted the Carnegie unit. It really hasn't changed very much at all. Now we serve many more students and a much greater diversity of students, and our completion rates are lower and so forth, but the way in which we deliver higher education hasn't changed particularly. And so I think it's just it's a bit of a silo thinking. People who have experience in other industries and who have seen how those industries have changed and been changed by technology, I think are better able to conceive of what higher education is going to look like 10, 20 years from now after technology has changed it. It hasn't changed yet. It's not going to change it through massive open online courses. The more appropriate analogy is through Uber, right? How Uber has sort of changed the taxi and limousine business by sort of becoming an intermediary and taking control of the sort of overall customer experience and redirecting resources accordingly. That hasn't happened in higher education yet, but as these competency marketplaces evolve, that's exactly what they're going to do. They're going to become the GPS. Students will rely on the information they provide. Employers will rely on the information they provide. And it's going to reorder the supply chain on the education and training side, which is, effectively the $500 billion spent today on colleges and universities.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we always have one final question on the New Books Network. What are you working on next? I know this is pretty recent for you, but any other projects that you have?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're spending a lot of time at University Ventures at the intersection of higher education and the workforce, and really fascinated by the emergence of dozens of intermediaries that are trying to bridge the gap between what colleges and universities deliver today what employers are looking for. And there are a range of models, companies that are, you know, if you will, charging the consumer, companies that are charging charging the employer, and companies that are charging universities, and then a range of services ranging from training to training plus placement or matching to matching services, and some really interesting new businesses that we are investing in that are trying to close the gap that exists today. So, from a writing standpoint, not so much, but from a investing standpoint, we're trying to select and pick what I think will be fast-growing companies that are going to help further shrink the gap between higher education and the labor market.
Okay, well, fantastic. And to all my audience out there, I want you to go check out College Disrupted, The Great Unbundling of Higher Education. And we have the author here, Ryan Craig, Managing Director of University Ventures. And Ryan, thank you very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you very much. And everyone out there, hope you learned something.